Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in the Federal Trade Commission against Indiana Federation.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case involves a conspiracy by Indiana dentists to refuse x-rays requested by group dental health care insurers. The insurers needed the x-rays to detect instances of fraudulent claims and overtreatment of dental patients. Their goal was to contain the costs of the insurance programs they were administering, a goal that was shared, indeed insisted upon, by those who were footing the bill for the programs, the employers and unions who had negotiated the dental benefits. The attitude of the dentist to this cost containment effort was best summed up in the words of Dr. David McClure, one of the chief organizers of the conspiracy here. Dr. McClure characterized the situation as, and I quote, economic war, where the name of the game is money. And like all wars, this one had its victims. Here they were the patients, the consumers, who were deprived of the benefits of the cost containment efforts of the insurance companies. The dentist's response to the insurance company's cost containment efforts should not be surprising, since, from their perspective, cost containment essentially means fewer dollars for the dentists. To again quote Dr. McClure, management, government, labor, and the insurance industry are determined to reduce the cost of the dental health dollar at the expense of the dentist. Now, a third-party payer faces a difficult problem with respect to cost containment. In the normal purchase transaction, the individual consumer has an interest in making sure that he is not paying for more than he needs. However, when an insurer is picking up the tab, the consumer's self-interest tends to coincide with that of the seller, which is to say, get as much as possible out of the insurance company. Thus, the responsibility is left to the plan administrator for finding some way of making sure that it is paying only for services that are covered under the contract. In this case, the dentists were well aware that the x-rays were needed for this purpose. To quote Dr. McClure yet again, the fight for x-rays will continue because this is the only way insurance companies can control their costs. The fight began with the Indiana Dental Association, which is composed of 85% of all licensed dentists in the state of Indiana. This group organized the boycott and did so very effectively. They adopted a set of principles of acceptability, which specified that insurance plans requiring x-rays to be submitted would not be acceptable. They distributed a form letter to their members to give to the patients saying that they would not provide the x-rays. They also initiated a pledge campaign.
Just not providing the x-rays.
That was the extent of the boycott. They refused to provide the x-rays. They initiated a pledge campaign for dentists to agree in writing that they would abide by the IDA's principles of acceptability.
They didn't refuse to serve patients that were covered by these health plans.
No, they would continue to serve patients. They just wouldn't give the x-rays to the insurance companies so they could determine whether the claim should be paid. The efforts were very successful, and the administrative law judge found that eventually most Indiana dentists were refusing to provide the x-rays to the insurers. Now, about that time, this court decided the Goldfarb case, which of course held that professionals do not enjoy any special immunity from the antitrust laws. The leaders of the IDA boycott were understandably nervous about their possible antitrust liability. The response was to form the Indiana Federation of Dentists, under the mistaken belief that if they styled themselves as a union, they would be immune from the antitrust laws. To once more quote the irrepressible Dr. McClure, who was the first president of Indiana Federation of Dentists, they would no longer have the antitrust albatross around their necks. The mandate of IFD was clear: to continue and intensify the boycott that was begun by IDA. Equally clear was the economic motivation for the formation of IFD, as evidenced by, among other things, the Constitution and bylaws. explicitly stated that IFD was organized to represent the socioeconomic and political interests of the dentists. The Constitution and bylaws authorized strikes, job actions, or other forms of economic pressure, and they provided for discipline of nonconforming members. Based on a record developed after 6 weeks of trial, the Commission concluded that this conduct reduced or eliminated competition among dentists as to their policy of dealing with third-party insurers.
Ms. Tiffany, the Commission refused to find that it had the result of diminishing competition among insurers, did it not?
The Commission declined to find the diminished competition among insurers.
The Commission seems to have conducted a sort of abbreviated rule of reason analysis here, not really doing a full-blown inquiry into the economic effects of the boycott, as I understand it.
That's correct. The rule of reason analysis was applied here, although the administrative law judge had found that a per se analysis would have been appropriate to this conduct. The line, however, between per se and rule of reason is not always a clear one, as this Court noted in the NCAA case.
But do you think an abbreviated rule of reason analysis is justified?
I don't believe we would refer to it as an abbreviated rule of reason. The analysis was conducted, a rule of reason analysis was conducted, and it was extensive enough, given the facts in this case, to reach the conclusions that the Commission reached. This restraint was very much like this Court has held, restraints this Court has held to be illegal without an elaborate market analysis. Paramount Famous Lasky is a case in point. That case, like this one, involved horizontal competitors who were refusing to deal with third parties except on terms and conditions that they had agreed to, that they had specified between themselves. It is also very much like the professional engineers case. Here, the dentists were restricting the flow of price-related information. If this information had been provided, it would have enabled insurers to determine whether the dentists are overtreating, which is the economic functional equivalent of overcharging. This, in turn, would have enabled the insurers to make purchasing determinations that would have lowered their costs. Thus, as was the case in professional engineers, while this is not a naked price restraint, it is a restraint that directly impacts price. Without this type of restraint, decisions as to the types of services purchased would have been made as the function of the interplay of the market forces. Now, the Seventh Circuit did reject the Commission's findings on an evidentiary basis, finding that there was some insubstantial evidence to show that the boycott restrained trade. This holding of the Seventh Circuit means that there's really a very narrow issue facing this Court, and that is whether the Court of Appeals misapplied the standard of review when it reversed the Commission's decision. The importance of this case, however, goes far beyond the narrow legal issue to be resolved here. The problem of cost containment in the context of third-party insurers is a large one. It has dimensions that really dwarf the facts in this particular case. As amicus briefs point out, the serious problem of rapidly rising health costs is one that's here to stay. Indeed, problems similar to those encountered by the insurance companies in Indiana are being faced throughout the country.
Well, is there something in this record that indicates that
furnishing these X-rays would be a step to contain costs? Did the Commission make any findings about that?
The administrative law judge made a finding that the cost containment efforts were generally, in general experience, were effective ones. With respect to Indiana, it was difficult.
With respect to the X-rays?
The X-rays were needed to make to do the cost containment. The X-rays were needed to do the alternate benefit determinations. And the administrative law judge did find that, in general experience, alternate benefit determinations have been effective in containing costs.
Did the Commission uphold that finding?
The Commission basically took the position that it really wasn't necessary to establish one way or the other that the cost containment efforts were, in fact, effective in this particular case, rather that the insurance companies were entitled to give an innovative cost containment effort a chance to operate, which they did not have here. And, in fact, that was one of the difficulties of getting evidence in Indiana, because right about the same time the insurance companies started the alternate benefit programs, the boycott began. So with respect to Indiana itself, the evidence is not complete. However, there certainly was evidence of similar restraints being used in other parts of the country. And, in fact, the Commission had entered a consent agreement in Texas involving dentists who had been involved in the very same conduct. In fact, there was some evidence that the Indiana dentists were attempting to export their boycott to other states.
How widespread is this practice?
Do you mean throughout the country or in Indiana? The references to the concerns throughout the country are fairly oblique in the record. It's enough to give the indication that there were that these were nationwide insurance programs and that they faced problems in other states. I do not know from the record how extensive boycotts are, although there clearly was one in Texas. In this case, this Court has the opportunity to send a clear message to professionals that they will not be permitted to act in concert to obstruct the innovative cost containment initiatives, and that lower courts may not accept unsubstantiated assertions of professional judgment by refusing to apply appropriate standards of review to the determinations of government agencies competitive conduct.
That may be a desirable goal or policy, but you're going to get around to saying how that restrains competition.
Yes.
I mean, how their conduct restrains competition, even if it maybe isn't in the public interest in terms of cost containment.
Well, there were several effects on competition. There were several ways that competition was restrained. First of all, it did interfere with the boycott interfered with the ability of the insurers to make these determinations as to whether they were being overcharged.
But how would that affect competition among dentists?
The competition among the dentists was certainly both for dollars and for patients. Patients were deprived of the ability to pick a dentist who would cooperate with their insurance company's cost containment programs, and as a result were deprived of the benefits of the cost containment efforts that their insurance companies were attempting to
take. Well, is that an injury to competition?
When the cost of
insurance...
When the patient
can't find a dentist who will send his x-rays in, does it restrain competition?
The competition was, yes, in fact, I believe it would be a restraint on competition. The competition was with respect to the policy of dealing with the third-party payers.
Well, Ms. Tiffany, Judge Fairchild's concurring opinion, he didn't join Judge Coffey's opinion, says pretty clearly no evidence was developed on the validity of an assumption that a dentist's policy of refusal or cooperation has any significance in competition among dentists, and the FTC decision fails to analyze the proposition. I take it you disagree with his opinion.
Yes, we do disagree with his opinion, Justice Rehnquist.
But it seems to me that the two talks about, you know, this is the battle for cost containment and this is the big picture. We have to figure out what evidence was developed right here in this case and not go to generalizations.
In the professional engineer's case, there was a restraint that dealt with bidding. Because of this restraint, the purchasers of the information, of the services, were not able to get information that would allow them to cost compare. Here, the purchasers have to be understood in the context both of the patients who are purchasing and the third-party insurer who is paying for it. The effect is essentially to have a bifurcated purchaser. You have one person who is going in and getting the service and the other who is making the decision as to whether they're going to buy that service and pay for it. Insofar as this restraint made it impossible for the insurance companies to do their part, to be able to make the determinations that they were willing to purchase this service, yes, it affected competition.
But how about the failure of the FTC to make a finding that it affected competition among insurers? Aren't you just trying to come in the back door with something the FTC refused to let in the front door?
That really would be a very secondary finding. Just as in the professional engineer's case, I mean, arguably the people who were purchasing the services from the engineers were going to be selling their buildings. The commission, by parallel, didn't find that it would interfere in their ability to sell buildings. Similarly, the commission didn't find that it would interfere in the insurance company's ability to sell insurance overall. It nevertheless did interfere with their ability to buy the services.
Well, but now what the FTC declined to find was that the dentist's concerted action reduced competition among insurers. Now, it seems to me when you say that the insurer is really another buyer and he was competing as buyer content, you're insisting there was a finding that the FTC refused to.
Oh, no, Justice Rehnquist. What the commission was really referring to there was the fact that lower prices for selling the insurance would make insurers more competitive between each other. That's the restraint between insurers that the commission was referring to.
Well, who's the buyer here? Is it the ultimate patient who wants dental services?
The buyer is really a bifurcated one. It's the patient who is getting the services, and it's the insurer who is paying
for them. What is the product here? Is it the advice necessary in order to monitor dental services? Is that the product?
No, Justice O'Connor. The product is dental services. And a decision has to be made as to whether those dental services will be purchased. That decision is being made both by the insurance company and the consumer. The patient goes in and has a problem. They want to purchase the service. The insurance company has to make a determination as to whether they're willing to pay for the service, whether they indeed are willing to purchase the service. When those two coincide, there's a transaction.
I would have thought perhaps the product was the advice or evaluation services that insurers provide in competition with dentists.
There certainly is an element of the insurer providing a second opinion, if you will, to the patient. And that was a loss to the patient, not having the benefit of this second opinion. However, that was only one of the many effects. And certainly the
— Maybe it's just a product effect, not a price effect.
I think that's right. The price effect had to do with not giving the insurers the information they needed to purchase the product. The commission had substantial evidence of the anti-competitive effects in this case to support their conclusions.
It's a resulted in reducing or eliminating competition among dentists as to their policy of dealing with third-party payers.
Yes.
That's what they really focused on, isn't
it? That is correct, Justice White. And they had substantial evidence to reach that conclusion. The market power here was substantial, both for the Indiana Dental Association and the Indiana Federation of Dentists. With respect to the Indiana Dental Association, 85% of all dentists in Indiana belonged, and the administrative law judge, Teeter, found that virtually all of them participated in the boycott.
Well, let's spell that out a little. Eliminating competition with respect to their policy of dealing with third-party payers, now how did that reduce competition among dentists? Is it that if some dentists furnished X-rays and some didn't, the ones that furnished them might get more patients?
Absolutely.
Because the word would get around here these hard noses won't really cooperate with my insurance company.
Absolutely, Justice White. And there is evidence in the record to support that. There was evidence of patients who, for example, crossed the Ohio River and went into Kentucky to find a dentist who would cooperate. The unions, who were very interested in promoting these plans and making these plans work.
Well, the commission could have said a little more than it did, it seems to me.
Justice White, in hindsight, we all perhaps could be more clear. And so, too, with the commission. But the evidence is there, and it is there in the record, and it is referenced in the commission's opinion.
One of the rules around when agencies, and I take it the FTC is an agency, one of the administrative rules is that you explain what you do.
That's correct.
Adequately.
And the commission.
Regardless of whether there's evidence in the record or not.
The commission did explain what it did, perhaps not as crystal clearly as it could have, but the explanation is there. And moreover, the evidence is there to support the conclusions that the commission reached. Let me address for a moment the legal, moral, and ethical justifications that have been raised in this case. The Commission gave the dentist every opportunity to come forward with a pro-competitive quality justification for their no X-ray policy. The Commission concluded, however, that the respondents failed to present any evidence of such quality justifications. Indeed, they did not even establish a logical nexus between the no X-ray policy and any possible patient quality of care concerns that they might have. This was not a case where the dentists were being asked to do anything improper with respect to the patients. The X-rays they were being asked to submit had already been taken as part of the diagnostic procedures. With respect to the lay examiners who were
To whom do the X-rays belong? To the patient or the dentist, you know?
I believe under Indiana law they are accessible to the Indiana law has been revised since then. They are now accessible to the patient.
Would the dentist have broken his some ethical rule if the patient had directed him to send the X-rays to the insurer and he had refused?
Only one that was constructed by the Indiana Dental Association pursuant to this boycott. They established it as some kind of an ethical rule. But certainly there was nothing in Indiana law that would have prohibited them from sending the X-rays.
Well, I know, but if a patient if a patient comes in and says, I want the X-rays you took of me, will the dentist give it to him? Or?
Under Indiana law, they now are required to give them to the patients.
Now?
Yes.
Were they?
I think at that time, the law did not address it one way or the other. It didn't say they could not.
But does not the dentist have a professional interest in maintaining the X-rays, at least by copy, in case he is conceivably sued for malpractice later and needs the X-rays to defend himself?
That's absolutely correct, Mr. Chief Justice. And the record shows that the insurance companies were sensitive to that. Indeed, in some instances, in trying to negotiate a plan that would be more acceptable, had agreed to do a double-pack X-ray, where the pack would take two X-rays at the same time, allowing the dentist to have one copy and sending the other copy into the insurer. And the insurer was willing to pay for the extra cost of that that type of X-ray pack, which was not really very substantial in any case. As to the lay examiners that were reviewing these claims, much has been made of lay examiners looking at X-rays, but the truth of the fact is that the lay examiners could only approve claims. They could not deny claims. It's difficult to imagine how having an insurance company approve the claim submitted by the treating dentist could in any way cause harm to a patient. As to the dental consultants who were reviewing the more questionable X-rays, these were licensed dentists. Contrary to respondents' assertions in its brief, the dentist did not rely on the X-rays alone when making determinations as to the alternate benefits. Rather, they could and did consult with treating dentists before determining the alternate benefit determinations, and moreover, these were professionals. They used their own professional judgment as to what additional information they needed, and, in fact, were able to access the information. There is nothing on the record that indicates that there was any restraint that they could not look at anything but X-rays. Indeed, there was no evidence here of any alternate benefit determination that was even medically erroneous. Moreover, nothing in Indiana law exists to justify this boycott. There is no express prohibition on laypersons screening the X-rays, and even if so, there was nothing in Indiana law that would authorize this kind of vigilante group boycott to enforce the law. If you strip away this legal, moral, and ethical veneer that the Seventh Circuit applied to this case, you really are left very much with a case like professional engineers, where the professionals were saying, we are the professionals, we know how to do things better than the antitrust laws do, better than the competitive market, we should not be subject to those constraints. Where legitimate pro-competitive justifications exist, this Court has indicated every willingness to countenance them. But professionals, like other entrepreneurs, have a direct economic incentive to keep the costs of their services high. This Court, accordingly, must demand more of professionals than a bare assertion that they know what is best. As I noted at the outset, this is a war, and the stakes are high. The costs of health insurance in general, and dental health insurance in particular, are extremely high and rising. If these dentists can successfully engage in this kind of obstructionist conduct in the face of the abundant record evidence to support the Commission's conclusion of the existence of an antitrust violation here, cost containment efforts in the healthcare field may well suffer a serious setback. Accordingly, the Commission respectfully requests this Court to reverse the decision of the Seventh Circuit below and direct that Court to affirm and enforce the order of the Federal Trade Commission. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve my time.
Mr. Graham.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Contrary to the theme of the Commission, this case should not be viewed as a crusade to lower dental costs. The Commission has not evidenced that these cost containment provisions did contain costs and specifically refused to do so at the administrative hearing. The focus of this case should be the proper application to a non-price restraint in, wherein there in, are involved valid health care concerns promulgated here by a small group of Indiana dentists, the IFD, and particularly the review that an appellate court should apply in reviewing the application of a rule of reason under these circumstances. Now, as we know, the Seventh Circuit clearly decided that the Commission had failed to evidence anti-competitive effect in a relevant market. Thus, absent the rare instance where the Court of Appeals grossly misapplied the substantial evidence standard, the Commission should not prevail today, and the Seventh Circuit's decision should stand. I think it's important to kind of look at this from the perspective of the Seventh Circuit as they were analyzing this case initially. They saw 88 dentists, which compromised the IFD, who had allegedly engaged in a restraint of trade. These 88 dentists were scattered around three parts of Indiana, and specifically in Fort Wayne, there were 19 IFD dentists out of 139 in the Fort Wayne area. The Commission, in their opinion, stated that they were applying a rule of reason analysis. The Seventh Circuit expected them to demonstrate a relevant market and anti-competitive effect in that market. They didn't do that.
The Commission at least said that no elaborate analysis was necessary to define the market, that this group spanned the state, and it was the state that was a relevant market.
Well,
I grant you it was in a footnote, but they said it anyway.
Well, that's right. They spoke briefly to market power and attributed the market power of Indiana Dental Association.
They spoke briefly to the definition of the market. Geographical market, anyway. Certainly there wasn't much question about what the product market was, is there?
Well, I'm not certain. I don't think they ever defined exactly what the product market was. That's one of the problems in this case. I believe that the Commission's core dispute, actually at this point in time, is that the Seventh Circuit required a full competitive rule of reason analysis, and that in that analysis, they considered IFD's quality of care justifications.
Mr. Graham, can I ask you kind of a preliminary question? As I understand it, this was a proceeding under Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act,
mm-hmm.
and the conclusion of the Commission was that there was an unfair method of competition had been found. There wasn't really a Sherman Act issue on its own terms in the case, was there?
Well, I believe that the Commission stated that they were applying Sherman Act principles.
I noticed they cited some Section 1 cases, but the section of the legal discussion is all under the rubric of Section 5. Do you think that makes any difference? I don't know whether it does or not.
Well, no, I believe the Seventh Circuit proceeded under the same theory I am, that the Commission stated they were employing Sherman Act principles, antitrust principles, and that's how the case was analyzed by the Commission.
And you think it's necessary to find a Section 1 violation in order for there to have been a Section 5 violation?
Yes, I do. That's what they stated they were doing. So, I mean, that's what I expected in the Seventh Circuit also did. Definitely, in this particular case, a rule of reason analysis, a full competitive rule of reason analysis was really required, and I think that's evidenced by a number of things. Initially, we find in the initial decision by the Commission a determination that IFD's actions were per se restraint of trade. Although the initial decision teased the idea that a rule of reason might be applicable in this case, they said there were no factors to outweigh the clearly anti-competitive effects that had been evidenced. Unfortunately, the initial decision never indicated what those were. Just continually referred to clearly anti-competitive effects. The final order of the Commission, upon the urging of the IFD, agreed that a rule of reason analysis should be applied, and they specifically stated a number of reasons why that is so. The Commission stated specifically the conduct involved in by IFD was not aimed at primarily at excluding competitors, was not wholly motivated by an anti-competitive purpose, and was a very limited refusal with regard to insurance company mandates. Only the X-ray was withheld. All other aspects of the insurer-dentist transaction continued. These are the Commission's findings as to why they applied a rule of reason and rejected per se. There are other findings in the Commission's decision which also support application of a rule of reason. They found that they refused to make a finding that there was any unfairness to consumers. They correctly found that the insurers were neither a customer or a competitor of the dentist. And they found that, in essence, there was no impact on price. And the Commission failed to evidence any impact on price in the dental industry.
Do you think that's a necessary element of their case?
It is if they're trying to analogize this to a price case. I think they should demonstrate.
Well, in a price case, would it be necessary to show that there was an impact on price?
If
you prove an agreement to fix prices, do you have to prove anything more?
If you demonstrate, I think if you demonstrate price fixing, you're either probably in a per se rule, or if it exists, some kind of truncated rule of reason analysis, which apparently they're touting now.
It's part of your submission that they must prove an impact on price in this case?
If it's a price case, or, as if they're saying, that we can apply somewhat of a truncated rule of reason analysis. They're analogizing this case to professional engineers, is what they're doing.
Did they prove an impact on price in professional engineers?
I think professional engineers was an absolute ban on competitive bidding. I think it was facially, for all intents and purposes.
But did they prove any impact on price?
Well, I don't think they necessarily had to because.
But you think they have to in this case?
In a rule of reason case, I think
whatever you call this case, do you think it's an essential ingredient of the Commission's case that they prove an impact on price?
Well,
in this case.
Or other anti-competitive effect. I think it's essential they prove some anti-competitive effect.
Well, of course, they claim they did.
Well, I know they claim that.
But what I'm really trying to find out is whether you think they had to prove an impact on price.
No, I don't think it was had anything to do with this case because this case is not a price case. Clearly, the Commission rejected the per se analysis and stated we're implying a rule of reason and cited to Chicago Board of Trade, which basically delineates the typical considerations to be analyzed in a rule of reason case. Unfortunately, they failed to carry out a proper rule of reason analysis, and the Seventh Circuit pointed this out to them. Now, only after the Seventh Circuit vacated the opinion, we see a new theory evolving on appeal. We see in the petition for rehearing in the Seventh Circuit, the Commission now stating that no elaborate analysis was necessary and that there are certain types of anti-competitive conduct that can be observed in the twinkling of an eye. And apparently, even now in the reply brief, apparently the Commission applied some kind of truncated sliding scale rule of reason analysis. Well, these are inventions of appellate counsel because they're not in the Commission's final order. And that's what the Seventh Circuit was reviewing. I think it's clear that a complete competitive rule of reason analysis was necessary here. Aside from the factors that the Commission themselves indicated, this is a novel case. The relationships in this case are not traditional. There's at least a three-party situation involving a patient, the dentist, the insurer, and possibly the employer of the patient who's paying for the dental services. Aside from all this, IFD presented valid, reasonably objective medical concerns about the practices of the dental insurers, which basically were that insurance companies were giving another opinion as to the necessity and adequacy of the treatment being provided by the dentist. I think this is clear. They were diagnosing. I think the initial decision admits this. The initial decision further indicates.
Well, why shouldn't an insurance company at least have a backup diagnosis of its own if it's going to pay the bill?
Well, I don't think that our clients have ever had any problem with having an insurance company do that, if they do it properly. The problem was the insurance companies were taking a single diagnostic aid, the X-ray. A dentist would look at that and say, well, this treatment's unnecessary.
Well, now, your opposing counsel says that these dentists assisting the insurance company didn't use just the X-ray.
Well, I beg to differ. I'll point to defer to the initial decision finding that's on page 240-241A of the appendix, where the administrative law judge admits it is not known what supplementation for diagnosis is being made by the insurance companies in Indiana. And not only is he admitting that they're diagnosing, but he's admitting, I don't know on what basis.
Well, why can't an insurance company say, all right, we don't have as much time as the dentist to spend on these individual cases. We've got to process them. We're going to make our backup judgment just on the basis of X-rays.
Because that would be fine if they were just trying to decide what their limits were on a particular case. If it's a $50 case or a $100 case, what they were doing was imposing less expensive but supposedly adequate treatment. And then they would inform the patient that, well, we're only going to pay for the treatment that is less expensive but adequate in our
opinion. You can't say that's not cost contained.
Yeah, it is, I don't think it contains cost. What it does is reduces treatment, because a patient is not going to opt to have treatment done when somebody else has told him that it's not necessary. It's not warranted.
He's probably not going to opt to have treatment done if the insurance company won't pay for it.
That's true. That is also true. And what it does is it changes the originally prescribed treatment plan based on an improper diagnosis without ever looking at the patient.
Oh, but how can you say the diagnosis is improper?
Because the work rule, the evidence at trial was uncontradicted. In fact, the administrative law judge made a finding that the experts, which we presented and others, all agree that an X-ray or any single diagnostic aid is not enough to make a proper diagnosis. That was the commission's finding.
Yeah, but that's a proper diagnosis for prescribing treatment, isn't it? Is there something unethical or improper about an insurance company writing a policy saying that when there are two alternate methods of treatment, we will reserve the right to decide which one we'll pay for?
No. But if you decide that there's a treatment that's adequate based on a very poor and medically unsound
basis. Well, adequate for the purpose of determining what they'll pay for. Don't they have that right? I don't understand this.
They have a right to determine what they're going to pay for, but they don't have a right to indicate that there are other treatments.
Well, can't they say the reason we won't pay for a gold filling is because we think a plastic filling is cheaper and that's adequate? Can't they?
Not
say
on the basis of an X-ray. They can't. That's the problem. An X-ray won't reveal what type of restorative material necessarily need be utilized. without.
Well, who should determine what to pay? Do you think they must? There's some legal rule they have to pay whatever the doctor prescribes for whatever the dentist thinks is appropriate?
No, Indiana Federation of Dentists never opposed cost containment by the insurance companies. What they opposed was their method of making a.
And they thought that the insurance company ought to send a dentist out and review the files on every patient. And the insurance company said, well, that would be much more expensive and will run up the cost of insurance. Isn't that what it's all about?
If the insurance company is going to diagnose, I think they ought to do it properly.
Because even though it's in a more expensive way and the cost of insurance will go up. Well,
that was never established.
I think there were findings to the effect that the processing method of going to the office by individual dentists would be a good deal more expensive. I thought that was in Judge Coffey acknowledged that, I thought.
There was evidence that it cost $10 a patient to do that. Aetna did that on a one-shot basis. There was also evidence that the cost to the dentist to comply with insurance company forms and cost them money, too.
And that's why they didn't want to supply the x-ray.
They supplied everything but the x-rays.
Yeah.
They supplied claim forms, narratives. They would speak to the insurance company on the phone.
Would you tell me again, just so I have it, what was the purpose of this refusal to supply x-rays in a nutshell? Why didn't the dentist want to do it?
Because insurance companies were making diagnoses.
They didn't want the insurance companies to engage in unethical practice of dentistry.
It was a second opinion based on an x-ray.
Is that the basic reason they did? They thought it was the insurance companies would be unlawfully engaged in the practice of dentistry if they can cooperate.
That's right, and I think that concern is evidenced additionally by the Indiana State Board of Dental Examiners since at least 1974.
Didn't the dentist submit a narrative explanation of what work they were proposing would be done?
The dentist would
submit. And isn't that available to the insurance company to review?
Yes, they did that.
Well, so they aren't relying just on the x-ray at all. They have the benefit of the narrative explanation. Isn't that so?
Yes, but the narrative is not. It goes much farther than that in making a diagnosis. I believe the Indiana Federation of Dentists work rule delineates what all the experts indicated was true. You can't just look at a single diagnostic aid or a summary in a claim form and decide that this treatment is not necessary. This treatment is not warranted, as the commission refers to it themselves.
But from what you've said, there was more supplied to the insurance company than just the x-ray. There was the proposed work, the outline of the work to be done, and the narrative description and the opinion of the examining dentist. So the insurance company has all that available, plus the x-ray if it's furnished.
And the evidence was that was not sufficient to effect another diagnosis.
Well, what else would they get by going to the dentist's office?
Which was
acceptable to the Indiana group.
Well, they could have all of the diagnostic aids. There could be models, impressions. There could be an oral exam, which Aetna conducted for some while on 4,700 patients, I believe. You're unable to observe the health conditions of the patient, how well he takes care of his teeth. There's a number of factors that go in.
Well, you don't propose that the insurance company has to physically examine the patient, surely.
All I propose is that they not diagnose unless they know what they're doing. And that's what the Federation of Dentists have contended.
May I follow up with just one question on that, Mr. Graham? If it's your position, if they supply the x-rays, that might lead to the unethical practice of dentists. But what if they supplied everything but the x-rays, and then the insurance companies did the best they could without the x-rays? Would that be the unethical practice of dentistry by the insurance companies?
Well, I believe so.
But weren't they willing to do that, supply everything else they wanted except the x-rays?
In the office, along with an oral examination.
Was it the dentist who insisted on having an insurance company person come to the office? Weren't they willing to send in a partial file, just excluding the x-ray?
They did that, yes.
Well, why didn't that raise exactly the same ethical problem as sending in the x-rays without without more material?
Because it was a narrative on a claim form. It wasn't a diagnostic aid that was being misused by the dentist at the insurance company.
Well, in both instances, the insurance company was trying to decide whether to pay the claim, wasn't it? Whether it had the X-ray or not.
No, they were trying to decide what treatment was the
what treatment they would pay for.
The cheapest treatment that they decided was adequate. That's what they were doing. In any event, there were at least valid medical concerns here of IFD that should have been looked at by the commission, and they weren't. The entire case was short-shifted. It was, as we know now, a truncated rule of analysis.
Has this sort of a boycott by dentists spread to other states, do you know?
There was similar concerns in the state of Texas, and I believe Pennsylvania. The record doesn't really reflect this. It does seem evident that right now the commission is now asking in the reply brief on page 10 that no elaborate industry analysis is required to demonstrate the anti-competitive effect of IFD's actions, citing professional engineers. This is a per se test that they're citing here. It seems to me that in an attempt to avoid their evidentiary requirements and prove anti-competitive effect, they are now saying, well, I think we can presume anti-competitive effect. It is apparently now a per se case again because they're citing the per se test. I think it's pretty evident what the commission did in this case was they stated they were going to apply a rule of reason, but they presumptively concluded IFD had engaged in anti-competitive conduct and then looked for proof of pro-competitive effects. Well, I don't think that's the way it works, especially in a novel case involving health care concerns. The rule of reason requires an analysis of the reasons for the restraint, the history of it, the facts peculiar to the business. That was not engaged in. Why do all these things need to be done to determine the competitive significance? We need to find out who's competing with who on what basis in what market and for what reasons. Why? So that there can be a demonstration of anti-competitive effect in a relevant market, as this court, I believe, has recently indicated again in Jefferson Parish. These are the same concerns the Seventh Circuit had. Where is the evidence of anti-competitive effect? What is the market that was affected? Well, the Seventh Circuit observed that the commission held that competition was lessened amongst dentists in their policy of dealing with third-party payer insurers. And that was their gist of their holding. The Seventh Circuit delineated just a series of factors that the commission had failed to even address in their series of conclusory assumptions about the market and competition. They pointed out that the commission had failed to define the market and the competitive forces. They pointed out that there was no real analysis of the total number of dental patients within the relevant market or the percentage of those covered by insurance in a relevant market, the availability and proximity of other dentists, the fees charged insured patients as opposed to uninsured patients, the policy of non-FDM member dentists in dealing with insurers, or the policy of insurers in evaluating dental treatment plans. There was no analysis of the additional cost to dentists in processing claims forms. There was no analysis of the potential disincentives posed to dentists for submitting diagnostic aids in violation of fairly well delineated state policies against it, dating back to 1974. No evidence of price alteration, price stabilization. You know, in short, I believe that the Seventh Circuit found that the competition at issue was not defined. They didn't know who competed with who, for what reason. Very little attention has been paid to the patient in this case, which is actually the ultimate consumer of dental benefits. They didn't demonstrate an effect on an undefined market. In conclusion, I believe that the Seventh Circuit's the commission stated we're applying a rule of reason analysis. Under the circumstances, it needed to be a rule of reason analysis. Thus, they had a burden to establish anti-competitive effect in a relevant market. The Commission is stating something differently now. They're asking for, I believe, a per se application, or at least some kind of truncated rule of reason application. Well, the Seventh Circuit found their analysis wholly deficient. They said rule of reason. They were obligated to establish the effects. And there simply is not a gross misapplication of the substantial evidence test by the Seventh Circuit. And for those reasons, we believe that the Commission should not prevail on their petition. Thank you.
Unless there are further questions from the bench, Mr. Chief Justice, I have no further comments.